Our final speaker is Judith A. Seltzer. She's a professor of sociology. She's a research affiliate at the Center for Demography and Ecology at UW-Madison and also with the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. She's just returned from a sabbatical as a visiting senior scholar at the Population Research Center of the RAND Corporation in California. She received her BA from Princeton, her MA and PhD from the University of Michigan. She did a postdoc at Johns Hopkins. For the past 10 years, she's been part of a research team involved in collecting data for the National Survey, Families, and Households. And she's also been involved in the evaluation of child support reforms here in Wisconsin. She's published extensively in some of the best journals in the field. She's presently co-editing a book on non-resident fathers. And, of course, I've read many of Judy's papers, but the first time I had the opportunity to hear her speak was last year at the National Council on Family Relations, where she talked about many similar things she's going to be talking about today. I thought she did a wonderful job. It was one of the highlights of the conference for me, and I was very pleased that she was willing to take time from her busy schedule to help us with the briefing report and also to present to you today. So let me introduce to you Professor Judith Seltzer. Let's give her a hand as she comes forward.
I'm going to take my task this morning as giving you a brief overview of what we know and also what we do not know about the effects of child support on children's well-being. Dan has already said something about children's economic welfare and child support, and I'm going to first step back and place this in the demographic context. And so I can keep on track, I'm going to show you the outline of my talk so you know as I near the end that you really don't have much longer to sit here quietly. First, I'm going to say very briefly something about where children live. Then I'll consider, sort of within that context, legal responsibility for children, joint legal custody, and paternity establishment. And after this, establishing this as the background, then I will say something about the effects of child support on children's social and emotional adjustment. And finally, I'll turn to looking at children's contact with non-resident parents, usually fathers, and say something about the effects of contact on children's well-being, and then give you a very brief conclusion. So don't worry, it won't be too long. Notice also that I've kept this barrier here between me and Karen's pink slips.
Right.
Good planning, I think.
I've got rollers on my chair.
All right, then I'll move on. Of course, one of the big motivations for concern with child support has been the growth of single-parent households in the United States, and Karen summarized much of the research there. I would like to show you on the next overhead a couple of additional points. First, you can see that about a quarter, actually a little more than a quarter of children in U.S. families today live in single-parent households, the blue segment on the first pie. And then you can see, as you move to the other side of the overhead, the percentage of children who live with mothers only versus fathers only. And here you can see that the vast majority of children, 87%, live in households maintained by their mothers rather than their fathers. And this is an important thing to keep in mind because I think the popular press pays quite a bit of attention to single father households without, again, reminding us that the vast majority of these families are maintained by women instead of by men. Another thing that you cannot see on the slide because census data doesn't capture it very well is that the percentage of children who live in shared placement homes or joint physical custody, it has a bunch of different names, sometimes dual residence. We don't have very good data on that from most studies. The studies that do capture that are state-based studies. And one recent California survey of divorced families shows that about one out of six families has the children sharing their time, not equally, but substantially in each parent's household. So it's a fairly liberal definition of joint physical custody, and it suggests, even with this liberal definition, that it's a fairly rare phenomenon. Now, an important point about that is that in Wisconsin, and I think nationally, the percentage of families with joint physical placement is growing, and I think it's growing rapidly. You've heard some of the reports from Racine and Jefferson counties, but I think it's also true at a national level. Let me turn now to legal parenthood. I feel a little funny talking about this to this audience since you all know a lot more about legal aspects of child support than I do. But because the audience is a little bit mixed, let me just give a brief definition of joint legal custody as a researcher looks at it, and that's the legal responsibility and right to make decisions about major aspects of the children's life. Now, in most instances, until recently, joint legal and physical custody of children coincided. The person who had physical custody of the child also could make the legal decisions about that child's life. In a substantial minority of cases, parents shared joint decision-making rights, joint legal custody, but the children lived primarily with their mothers. Recent national data suggests that for all separated families, this only occurs in about 11% of the cases. For divorced families, it's somewhat more common, maybe 16 to 17%. But I think that aggregate figure masks a very important trend, and that's shown in the next overhead. Let me remind those of you in the back who have trouble reading the smaller print there, as I even do from here, that this is in your handouts as well. You can see from this that the percentage of families with joint legal custody has grown rapidly over the past 15 years or so, so that by the mid-1980s, about 27 to 30% of recently separated families had joint legal custody assigned, and that is more than twice as frequent, as high an incident as in the mid-1970s. So again, I think this is an important issue that child support policy will need to contend with, especially as this trend continues into the future. Let me say a bit about joint legal custody and how that's related to child support. The basic premise behind joint legal custody is that it makes the lives of children in single-parent households more similar to those of children in two-parent households, that they have two parents involved with them. Studies that look at the relationship between joint legal custody and such outcomes as visiting and compliance with child support generally show that families with joint legal custody, in those families, the non-resident father spends more time with the child, has more frequent visits, longer periods of visits, compared to families in which fathers do not have joint legal custody. The results on child support compliance are very mixed. Some studies show that compliance is higher in these families, and some that it's lower, and some show absolutely no relationship. I think one reason for these inconsistent findings is that the studies vary in how well they take account of the amount of time that children spend in the father's home, time when he is spending money directly on the children instead of transferring child support to the child's mother. So I think the jury is still out on the bottom line there, but I think there are good reasons for the inconsistencies across studies, and I think we know what to do next to try to address that. We do know also from these studies that parents with higher incomes and more education are more likely to acquire joint legal custody, and these greater access to economic resources do explain some of the higher child support payments that a few of the studies I've already described report. Let me consider now an aspect of legal parenthood from the point of view of children who are born in non-marital relationships, and that is the establishment of legal paternity. From a sociologist's point of view, the father of a child is often quite evident. He may be involved in the child's life. Everybody in the community knows who the father is. He may be living with the mother or have a long-term relationship. But that's not the same thing as the legal definition of who a child's father is. And as Dan said, that's the first step in establishing a child support award. During the mid-1980s, only about a third of non-marital births had legal paternity established for them. And there's huge variation across states and even across counties in how common it is to establish legal paternity for children. From the point of view of my task, the question is, how does establishing legal paternity affect children's welfare? Clearly, it provides children it provides children with access to father's economic resources. It gives them rights to his health insurance, his Social Security, and other benefits. But we don't really know yet what the effects of more rigorous paternity establishment will be on children's other aspects of children's welfare besides economic. There's good reason to expect that legal paternity establishment will increase contact in non-marital families, contact between non-resident fathers and children, and also that it will increase contact between non-resident fathers and resident mothers in those families. A priori, that may sound like a good thing, but I think we also need to keep in mind that these rigorous attempts to establish paternity may also increase the conflict to which children are exposed. If by bringing former couple together who would otherwise prefer to stay apart and avoid each other because of their disagreements, we're increasing the chances that the child will be exposed to parents' conflict. And that's a point that I'm going to return to in a few minutes. Now let me turn your attention back to one of the questions that Dan was looking at, and that's what's the effect of child support on children's economic welfare? And the answer is that it has some impact on children's economic welfare, improving that. Now I'm going to ask the question a little bit differently and say, what does child support do besides improve income? Does it do anything else for children? There's suggestive evidence from a growing number of studies that child support is associated with better children's behavior in school and better school achievement. So on that level, we can, at least in the aggregate, say it looks good at first. And we also find from these same studies that compare the effects of child support dollars to the effects of dollars from other sources, say earnings or AFDC, that child support dollars do more to improve children's school achievement and behavior than they do these dollars from other sources. So the big question here is, why is that? Is there some other aspect of fathers or families that we're not taking into account, or is it really that child support dollars are better dollars than dollars from some other source? And you can see that I've marked this big question in red because we just got a color printer at work, and I had access yesterday after 5 p.m., and I got to play with it. Okay, on the next overhead, which I'm afraid is back to black and white, I propose some answers that are consistent with the evidence on from studies of children's well-being. One is that child support may have a symbolic meaning to children, that it makes them feel as though their fathers care about them, and it's that improves their emotional stability. Another possibility is that fathers who pay support also spend more time with their children, and it's this combination of activities that gives children a stronger sense of themselves and reassures them. A third possibility is that in families in which child support is paid, the parents get along better, and it's the absence of conflict that accounts for children's better well-being in these families. Now, these are all testable hypotheses, and as I say, those possibilities come from previous work on children and child support. What I can tell you about the preliminary results of looking at these competing explanations is that even in studies that take account of how much time parents spend with their children and take account of how much conflict there is between the two parents, child support still has a positive association with children's well-being. Children and families where fathers pay child support do better than children and families where fathers do not pay child support, even controlling for these other explanations. So I think what that suggests is that more rigorous child support enforcement may benefit children. And our research suggests that not only will it benefit children, but that even if it exposes them to a little bit more conflict, that may not be the worst thing, because the economic benefits may compensate for that. It's important to remember that our findings about divorced families do not always show up the same as families for non-marital families. And in the studies where we've tried to look at the effects of child support on child well-being, we find that the effects differ for divorced and non-marital families, probably because the more extreme levels of conflict in non-marital families compared to divorced families. So more rigorous enforcement may have a net benefit for children of divorce, and it may not, our results suggest, for children from non-marital families. Let me turn now to the topic to which I've already alluded in this slide, and that is fathers' contact with children with whom they do not live. I've already said that fathers who pay child support spend more time with their children, they're more likely to see them. It's unclear from all of the studies, both in my own research and in all the research I've been able to read about this, it's unclear whether this is a cause and effect relationship or whether there's some third factor driving both paying child support and spending time with kids, like the father cares about the children. That seems like a good possibility. Also, the quality of the parents' relationship. We've been unable to tease out why the two are related, but they seem fairly consistently to be related. And I think from a policy point of view, that's important because family law generally separates paying support and visiting children or access to children rather than the behaviors which put the two together. On the next overhead, I went back to the color printer. And this pie chart gives you a sense of how common contact between non-resident fathers and children is. You can see, if you look at both the white segment and the crosshatch segment, that about 40% of fathers haven't seen their child in the past year. This is a very high level of disengagement. If the mother is the non-resident parent, contact is somewhat higher. It's more likely to occur in the past year compared to fathers. But again, fathers are more commonly the non-resident parent. Even though there is this high level of disengagement, a huge chunk of children have seen their father at least weekly and so have continuous and frequent contact with him. Over 25% see them at least weekly. From children's point of view, even children who don't have real frequent contact with their non-resident parents often describe their relationship with that parent as being a close relationship. It's important to the child, even if it's not daily contact. Most national studies find no effect of the amount of contact between the non-resident parent and the child's well-being. This is a number of national studies, a very consistent finding, different ways of measuring contact. Now, as a researcher, I feel that I need to make an apology here because this is a fairly naive view of what it is that goes on in children's lives, just counting the number of visits or counting the number of times the father shows up at the child's household or the child goes to the father's home. Instead, what's important is what goes on when the father and child are together. One of the most important factors that hasn't been included in these studies is the amount of conflict between parents who live apart and how that might affect the relationship between the father's contact with the child and child well-being. I think I'm ready for the next overhead, especially since I got pink slip. Okay, so here's the first point that I've just made, that the effects of contact depend on the conflict between the parents. And studies that do take a more sophisticated view of the child well-being study find that when conflict is high, contact between non-resident fathers and children increases behavior problems, and when conflict is low or it's controlled so that the child doesn't know about it, children benefit from contact with the non-resident parent. This research also shows that even high conflict parents can develop some techniques for getting along with each other in a way that doesn't harm their child by exposing them to conflict. And one of the strategies that parents adopt is by, one of my colleagues calls it parallel parenting. They set up separate households. They don't deal with each other very much. They disengage from each other, but they focus their attention on the child. The research on children suggests that if children aren't drawn into parents' fights, if they don't feel responsible for maintaining their polite relationship, and if they feel protected from this conflict, then children do better. They're less likely to be depressed. They're less likely to have deviant behaviors, whereas children who are pulled into parents' conflict have these problems. Now, one of the things that I find interesting about this research is that the disengagement style becomes increasingly common the longer parents have been separated. It's not clear whether parents just stop wanting to deal with each other at all, because it's too difficult, or whether there's some kind of learning process where parents have this short-term period when life is very hard and they're all figuring out their new family relationships, and then they figure out that one way of dealing with each other is by separating, or whether it's other things that come up in the parents' lives, remarriage, move to a new place, a new city, which accounts for the increasing level of disengagement. Let me conclude now by stating explicitly what's been implicit in much of my talk, and that is, what are the implications of these findings for an understanding of increased child support enforcement in the United States? I think that the child support reforms, especially more rigorous establishment of paternity and more rigorous enforcement of established awards or orders, will increase the proportion of children who are exposed to their parents' conflict. It'll increase the exposure of children to parents who don't agree with each other at all, but who, because of the system, are forced to deal with each other at least some level. in this case, then, we're kind of pitting children's economic welfare against their social and emotional welfare. And the trick is then to see if there's a way to help parents manage their lives with each other, because the system is forcing them together at the same time that they fulfill their obligations to the child and possibly to the state. I think that in this instance, it's likely that we should pay policy attention both to parent education programs and mediation programs, where I think the results are not real clear yet that that's what helps children, but it's clear that children and parents need some help on this level of managing the conflict, which may negate the benefits of the economic reforms to child support.
With the new opportunities for adjusting the level of the percentage of child support depending on how much time the child spends in the home of each parent, have there been any recent studies that have shown how this affects children? We've heard earlier that this increases conflict between parents, and Judy, you talked about the effect of conflicts on children's well-being. So has there been any studies of how this new provision is affecting children's well-being? Is that...
Good summary. I don't know of any studies, although Pat Brown from the Institute for Research on Poverty is sitting in the back, and she may. Do you, Pat? Do you know... I do. Some of the studies that I described to you just now are about families where joint legal custody and shared placement are more common. It's from a California study, and that is where the evidence about the negative effects of conflict on children, especially in shared, when there's a lot of contact between the two parents, that's where those findings come from. But I think it's a very important research question, and as soon as we get data, I think there'll be people standing in line to try and figure that out.
So the answer in the back from Pat Brown was that it's too new, and we haven't studied it yet. And the question now is based on the California studies, is there any indication of what we may be able to do about this issue?
Not based on the California studies, but based on a parallel line of research on the effects of mediation and also on parent education. I think those strategies offer some potential for helping parents. And in fact, one of the authors of the California study has more recently advocated some types of mediation as a way of managing conflict between parents who are separated. My own reading of that literature is that the results are quite mixed, that parents are more likely to say they're satisfied about their arrangements if they have mediation, but they're not more likely to comply with the terms of that arrangement once it's established through mediation. I'm not sure what those studies find about continued conflict between parents, but the fact that they don't find that compliance is higher in those families suggests that there may be some conflict that continues as well.
I was just going to comment that one of the studies out of that Mnookin Maccabee California study asked children of a certain age, and I think they were sort of pre-adolescent. I haven't looked at that study for a long time, so and asked them, what they thought, how their feelings were, and they came out with an interesting result that the children in the shared time arrangements felt that they were better off.
So the question regards conflict. It must be quite difficult to measure. Is it measured differently in different studies? Is it determined by context, by culture? And how has this been handled in studies?
It sounds like a prelim question. let me give you a shorter version, and if you want more detail, I'd be happy to provide it. In my summary of the results, I'm using evidence from a variety of studies using a variety of measures of conflict. I did not restrict my attention to the most extreme cases, say, of physical abuse. I tried to talk more generally about the kind of conflict that more families would experience. Within that category, the studies try to talk about more or less of conflict, and they measure that in different ways, including verbal disagreements, throwing things at walls, mother's reports versus father's reports. The results mostly that I've cited to are controlling for some indicators of cultural attachment, like race and ethnicity, education, and so on. And so I've reported to you net effects, taking account of a lot of the problems you raise in measuring conflict. Now, I think a more serious concern is that often our results about conflict come from studies that speak only to women, mothers, and not to fathers. On the plus side of that, if the child is living with the mother, that may be a more direct indicator of what the child's exposed to than the father's report. On the other hand, the whole point of these child support reforms, as I see them, is to tie both parents to the child. And so you would want the other parent, the father, his report as well. Some of the studies do talk to fathers, and as I say, I've tried to provide an accurate description of their results, but there are fewer of those studies, and so I think the results are somewhat less reliable.
Judy, do you have an assessment of how many families experience conflict? Or is it hard to say?
Well, again, it depends on how you measure conflict. Studies that try to look at problems with access or visitation, some of the recent attempts to evaluate the federal demonstration efforts in access provisions, find a range of between 1 out of 5 and 1 out of 25 families have serious enough problems about access or visitation that they come back to court. That's a very big range, I think, but it certainly is a minority of families with problems at that level. If you want to take a different tack and look at national survey data, I think maybe 50% of resident mothers report no conflict, something like that. I'm citing my own research, but I can't remember the exact figure, so it's very embarrassing.
I'm sorry, my intent was not to embarrass you.
Well, I forgive you.
Okay.